It also had the protection of geography and a couple of, and a few pretty significant profits. But you can't appreciate how the early, how Israel still aspired to a son of David, to a Messiah like David, unless you appreciate that they saw and understood that one of the stabilizing factors for Judah was really the continuous dynasty. So instead of there being a continuity, in that day he will speak out saying, I will not be a healer, and in my house there is neither bread nor mantle. You will not make me leader of the people. For Jerusalem has stumbled and Judah has fallen, because their speech and their deeds are against the Lord, defying his glorious presence. The capable people will wash their hands of the situation and think it's too far gone to be involved in. That's a bad situation. When the people who have the resources for leadership decide that leadership is a waste and leave. Their partiality witnesses against them. They proclaim their sin like Sodom. They do not hide it. Woe to them, for they have brought evil upon themselves. Tell the righteous that it shall be well with them, for they shall eat the fruit of their deeds. Woe to the wicked. It shall be ill with him, for what his hands have done shall be done to him. Fundamental notion of judgment is that you get back what you give out. And the judgments of Yahweh were not so much arbitrary as they were proportionate. And the great picture, is that Yahweh will return to Israel and to Judah what Israel and Judah has done to themselves and to their neighbors. For my people, children, are there oppressors and women rule over them? Maybe that, in our day, we'd probably think that was a pretty good idea rather than a liability. Oh, my people, your leaders mislead you and confuse the course of your paths. The Lord has taken his place to contend. He stands to judge his people. Notice, the Lord begins his presence in Israel as a lawyer. The prophet understands God to be working in Israel as a voice which accuses, which brings charges, which asks, which really conducts they use over and over again the notion of the court, where God is sometimes the prosecuting attorney and sometimes the judge. The thing that blows my mind, coming from the context of a Christianity which very frequently in our time is concerned only, not wrongly, but only, with the supportiveness of persons, family communities, the church community, the thing that sort of blows my mind about the prophets is that they're really advocating as a task, as a God-given task, the comment, criticism, interpretation of the whole social order. So that the vocation of the prophet to be prophetic is a vocation to comment on the life of the whole people, to begin to support and to generate the kind of contentious, the kind of contending, and contentiousness which will enable the people to go back to covenant, to renew and relive Torah. The Lord enters into judgment with the elders and the princes of his people. It is you who have devoured the vineyard. The spoil of the poor is in your houses. What do you mean by crushing my people, by grinding the face of the poor, says the Lord God of hosts? So that the presence of Yahweh is known and seen and heard. The presence of Yahweh is known and seen and heard in the voices that contend and advocate concern, advocate attention to, and I like Al Pischer's word very much, that advocate attending to, much more modest and realistic than solving. You know, we all think we're going to solve every problem, but maybe what we need to do is to start attending to certain kinds of concerns and problems. There's one other oracle in this first section. After this anarchy picture that I want to include before we move on to the next section, because it's a marvelous, as anarchy is the final result of lack of consensus and covenant vision for the people, so in the future, the result of renewal of vision, renewal of covenant, is a kind of center of justice, a place where conflicts can be resolved and decided. The prophets nowhere want a society which is inert and totally accepting. They think that debate and criticism is the source of repentance, and in the future they see a society in which conflicts can be resolved, not avoided. Now, if you look at 2:1-4, you have then the beginning of the Messianic Age oracles. It's a vision of peace. It's a vision of, it's almost a vision of a League of Nations or World Court being established in Jerusalem. And the major issue in interpreting this passage, as I see it, is whether you believe this is really going to happen, and this is something that we ought to be about as Christians who have heard the prophetic word very incarnately in Jesus Christ, or whether you think that this is simply an ideal for the era beyond history, for a kind of inner meaning.
This scripture makes me think of a strange thing from Woodrow Wilson, who said to one of his rather ugly daughters once, if you at least imagine that you're beautiful, perhaps you will at least appear handsome to others because of the self-confidence. That is to say, this is such an impossible ideal. At least this impossible ideal will raise you this high, but not to perfection.
where there is no vision, people perish. And part of the strength and power of the prophets was their sensitivity, their imagination, which enabled them to project the consequences, the long-term consequences of the present behavior, and to project the future possibilities and goodnesses if there was a change of direction.
I'm still the same idea there too. I would hope that you would look in a positive vein. You know, I am ugly. I hope I can make myself beautiful, but maybe a nation really striving for these goals, not even looking at the ugliness, but just outright blind positiveness of moving forward to try to improve a situation. It is maybe beyond reach, but not trying to hide something, but still just really trying. And maybe it will fall short, but don't assume it's going to fall short. I guess just to try to take out that thing of assuming that you can never make it, try.
Now this is
with the power of God that He will take you as far as you can go.
Well, this is where the prophets, this is, and I think this is one of the fundamental advantages that the monotheist, that the person who still shares in the God story has over the person who has only the man story. When you are part of the God story, that impossible future will happen because it's within the sovereignty of God. So that what Isaiah foresees, he sees this destruction and he sees it happening because that's the consequences in God's time of this. And he sees that the new day will happen because the resources depend not on Israel's possibilities, but on the God reservoir rather than the man reservoir. And the prophets saw, in distinction from the other communities whose gods were much more like, you know, you go over to Olympus and it's really, you had the common people, you had the nobility, and you had the gods on Olympus, just one class higher than the aristocrats. And the prophets really saw they were good gods in the sense that they were comfortable, humane, congenial, courteous, gentlemen, and vicious like gentlemen. But the prophets saw a God character of a different order, where God opened up reservoirs of goodness and unity and integrity that were simply not honestly conceivable and realistic in terms of the resources of the people. And it shall come to pass in the latter days that the mountain of the house of the Lord, the mountain of the house of the Lord, the hill in Jerusalem where the temple was built, shall be established as the highest of the mountains and shall be raised above the hills. Space in a world fresh from myth is a symbol of value. So that the sense of the tall, the high is suggests something, suggests status rather than actual height. Shall be established as the highest of the mountains and shall be raised above the hills, and all the nations shall flow to it, and many people shall come and say, come, let us go up to the mountain of the Lord, to the house of the Lord, to the house of the God of Jacob, that he may teach us his ways, that we may walk in his paths. There shall be the recognition that if there is to be a human society, that it's grounded and rooted in some kind of fundamental, ultimate understanding. There must be some breakthrough. There must be some breakthrough to the ultimates which are true for the whole human society. And when those have broken forth, then people from all the nations will come and learn. He shall judge, but for out of Zion shall go forth the law, the way, and the word of the Lord from Jerusalem. For from this place there will go out the ideals of what a full humanity is, and the word of the Lord, the criticism, the provokingness, the opening of people to self-examination. And then you have the court image continued. First you have the sort of teaching image, and then you have the court image. He shall judge between the nations and shall decide for many peoples. Notice, then the beautiful line. If there is a consensus about goodness, if there is a source of goals for humanity, and if there is a place where the disagreements can be resolved, and where the injustices can be righted, he shall judge between the nations and shall decide for many peoples. If goals can be trusted and justice, instruments, institutions of justice function, then men need not learn war anymore.
Vern, back to number two. Some scholars say that many of the psalms are what you call pilgrim psalms, which they quoted or sang as they went to Jerusalem. So a rather literal meaning of I will lift up mine eyes into the hills is seen in verse 2. I will lift up mine eyes into the hills from which cometh my help. Not any hill, but specifically Jerusalem, high on the hill.
The psalm you're quoting, I understand to be a despair voice later, or similarly about the decline in Jerusalem. And at this point, Isaiah is talking not about the emptiness in Zion. The last oracle was about the anarchy that resulted because of the failure of leadership in Zion, the decline of Zion. This oracle is the hope, the vision, the long-term vision. Isaiah or somebody after Isaiah still hopes that the hill, the holy mountain, will become a point of dissemination of law and justice for all the peoples, will still become a light. And this is, I think that there needs to be a great, great and serious debate about whether the picture of the new justice proceeding from Zion, or even a new justice from Christ, whether this is something that we should expect as closely as Isaiah expects it, expect it in terms of, and work for it in terms of, this side of the human boundary, or whether it is something that one only longs for because one does not find it, this side of the human boundary. Some of the pictures are so fundamental that even when the people of God despair totally about what they can do now, they hang on to them as defining the graciousness and direction of God's life. The thing that concerns me is that sometimes coming out of times when one has been able to do nothing, where there have been no resources, the people of God continue to live in that passive dependence, when they have in fact come into a time and a place when they can do something. Sometimes I think that we, as the people of Christ, think we're in the wilderness when we're really in the promised land. Sometimes I think America acts like it's a poor, underdeveloped country when it's really very rich. Sometimes I think we middle class talk like we are helpless when we simply are, when there really is some power, but it's confused and difficult to exercise. Anyhow, the prophet foresees the time and the place, when there shall be teaching about the common direction of human life, and when there shall be the settlement of disputes by judgment, and they shall beat their swords. Even way back then, and the puny little wars they had, you know, with only really small amounts of permanent damage compared to our wars, even way back then, they understood that disputes should be resolved by judgment, not by might and power. He shall judge, and they shall beat their swords into plowshares, their spears into pruning hooks. Nation shall not lift up sword against nation, neither shall they learn war anymore. Can you imagine the day of the Lord, when there is a source of teaching and justice, and nation shall not lift up sword against nation, and none of us here or in the Orient or in Middle Asia, none of us shall learn war anymore. We'll do the Song of the Vineyard tomorrow in 5:1, beginning at 5, verse 1. We'll do Isaiah's call in chapter 6, and maybe his chapter 7 is a wonderful, well, it's really political advice, and it shows you how thoroughly secular his preaching was. I mean, he's really trying to give advice to the king of Judah about how to get along with Assyria. and Israel. And it's and if most of you probably have Bibles in which there's some footnotes, and you'll notice that chapter 7 is footnoted to 2 Kings. And the story behind chapter 7 is in the 2 Kings passage. A couple of poetic things to note in their poetry and in their thinking. One is that they'll very often picture the whole by the part. So they'll talk about Ephraim and mean Israel. The way of being concrete. A particular label can label the whole.
In rhetoric, that's called semantic. I believe.
That's a good word.
Good word.
And the other thing they do is they understand a sufficient organic connection between people and mountains and sky, so that they will talk about the universe and the creation sort of echoing what's happening to the human people. Anyhow.
Close the door, please.
That's my wife.
Verse 17, the Lord will bring upon you and upon your people, upon your father's house, such days as have not come since the day that Ephraim departed from Judah, namely the king of Assyria. Now, when you really read that oracle, that really isn't a messianic passage at all. The talk about a woman conceiving and bearing a son is a what I would call signs of the times passage. In other words, the birth of the child and the naming of the child is to designate a passage of time and to suggest a kind of meaning. And Emmanuel in this context, God with us, means that that God is going to act to judge Israel and Judah. And so Emmanuel, the Hebrew word for near, and El, one of the generic terms for God, Emmanuel, is to say that God is near, God is close by, and what I understand Isaiah to be doing, and I really wish the passage didn't come out this way, because I like it better the way the Christians understood it. You know, I really liked it better the other way. But as near as I can tell, what the words in the text actually say are that that there's going to be a child, probably, very likely, another child of Isaiah. There's going to be a child. He's going to have a symbolic name, Emmanuel. When he reaches the age of discretion, it's going to be depression time. He's going to eat curds and honey. The lands of the two kings who are now threatening Israel will be deserted, and Assyria will itself come upon Judah. So that, in fact, this passage becomes then a child symbol, or a birth, mother and child symbol, which is a symbol of the passage of time and the length of time, a generation's time, which will be the length of time it will take the Lord to work out his accountability in Israel. And if any of you can see another way to read the passage in the context it's in, I would be indebted to you. I have one principle that I cannot give on, really, because I think to give on it would be to to abandon the plain sense of text, and that's that the first meaning, not always the last meaning, but the first meaning of a text is the text it has in its context. So that if you figure out what the words of verse 14 mean apart from its context in Isaiah, I guess I would have to say I can't agree with you, because I think you're taking the word out of the place it comes from. So. So that if you figure out what the words of verse 14 mean apart from its context in Isaiah, I guess I would have to say I can't agree with you, because I think you're taking the word out of the place it comes from. So at any rate, the conundrum we start with is the thoroughgoingly political character of this section of Isaiah, the thoroughgoingly the words which seem on the one hand to be reassurance to Ahaz that he shouldn't be so scared to death of Syria and Israel, and on the other hand to remind Ahaz that Judah will probably be destroyed and overrun by Assyria as well. So that as I see the point of this oracle, there is a kind of reassurance. You are too insecure on the one hand, and you're too secure on the other. You're too insecure because you're threatened by Israel and Syria, but you're a fool if you think you can, in the long run, count on Assyria. Assyria will be a help in the short run and a threat in the long run. Now, this is just a little bit of recap. If you go back to 2 Kings 16, chapter 16, there's a wonderful long chapter telling about Ahaz. and telling a little bit about the situation. It's a kind of tragic situation, because here is Judah, and here is their sister Samaria on the north, and Samaria, which was the traditional, you know, the other half of Israel, which was traditionally the people of promise, has made an alliance with the kingdom to the north of Samaria, so that the king of Syria and the king of Samaria are in league together, and they're coming at Jerusalem. And how to picture this? Judah's down here in the hill country. Samaria is in the plain and the foothills leading up to the hill country. Syria is up here, and the pathway between Assyria and Egypt is from the two rivers across the Fertile Crescent, down the coast, and into Egypt. And Ahaz, well, there's some interesting things. He goes up to Damascus and he sees the neat bronze altars that they have in Damascus. And so he comes back and he has the temple remodeled and has the old traditional altar thrown out and a bigger, fancier bronze altar put up. He has the other one moved up, and he tells the priest, you've got to say that you've got to have the big sacrifices on the new bronze altar, and he changes around some of the decorations in the temple. So he clearly is an impressionable, you know, he's a sophisticated king on the make, and he's impressed with the spectacle of the religion in Syria, and he's impressed with Assyrian power. And Syria is to the north. Assyria is over in the Tigris-Euphrates Valley. And he sends, and he takes, he's trying to get, see, he's afraid of Samaria and Syria, and so he kind of entices the king of Assyria to come over and go after the king of Syria and Samaria. And he thinks he can get them, he thinks he can do that without them coming all the way up to Jerusalem, and Isaiah is kind of somehow encouraging in this whole thing. So he takes some of the things from the temple, takes some of them, the gold and worship objects and some of the temple treasury, and sends it off to Assyria as kind of bait to come, you know, just really not sophisticated and naive at the same time, you know. How shrewd the politician, and how ultimately stupid. Because here he's paying Assyria a tribute to come and knock over Syria and Samaria, but at the same time, he's just blatantly telling the king of Assyria, look at the kind of gold we've got in the temple in Jerusalem. So at the same time, he's giving Assyria an excuse to come and get into the act. He's also showing the king of Assyria that Judah's kind of wealthy, and maybe he shouldn't stop at Samaria but go on up to Jerusalem too. And so it's a really...
There's a feeble parallel, if I remember faintly. We tend to romanticize Greece in our own age in college, but the degenerate Greek kingdoms were so horrible that the people in what we now call Palestine sent a delegation down to Alexandria, Egypt, and asked the Romans to come up and chase the degenerate Syrian-Greeks out. So that's why the Romans occupied Jerusalem when Christ was there. And look what they had on their hands. It may have been better than those degenerate Greeks of an earlier kingdom, but it was an amazingly feeble parallel there.
Well, it's amazing. The important thing to realize is that these oracles are born out of precarious political situations. They are not born out of mysticism in the desert. They are born out of sensitive
They have
poet preachers who are in the midst of a small country which lives very precariously among its neighbors. Now, Isaiah's oracles to Ahaz, Isaiah's sort of advice on behalf of the Lord, really center around three named children. You remember when we were talking with talking about Hosea, that Hosea kept having kids and giving them symbolic names. In the translation in Hosea, they gave up putting, sometimes they transliterate these names and sometimes they translate them, because, and they have such impossible Hebrew names, so that Hosea had these kids not pitied, and you are not my people, and then later on in the story, the Lord's going to change the names of the children so that not pitied will be pitied, and you not my people will be my people. In other words, one of the syllables of the name will be dropped off, and the whole significance of the child's name will be turned around. Now, it's a rather interesting couple of the whole family getting into the prophetic act. You know, the family life, the having of children, provided an occasion. A name was a very special thing. A name somehow created identity, and so that to give these children names was a pretext and a way of announcing, presenting an idea and a concept, so that you get, you know, I suppose our kids would really have a fit if we started putting these kind of unpronounceables on them, but that was one of the ways they did it. So that there's a series of three names. The first one, the middle one is Emmanuel. The first one is Sha'ar Jashub. And the last one is over at the end of in chapter 8, Mahershal Ahashbaz. First sign is the sign connected with the naming of Sha'ar Jashub, your son. And fortunately, there are footnotes, and that name means a remnant shall return. And so Isaiah goes to meet Ahaz with his son. This is verse 7:3. At the end of the conduit of the upper pool on the highway to the fuller's field, and say to him, take heed, be quiet, do not fear, do not let your heart be faint, because of the two smoldering stumps. This is Syria and Damascus, Syria and Israel, two smoldering stumps of firebrands. And then there's an inapposition, the names, the fierce anger of Rezin and Syria and the son of Remaliah. Because Syria with Ephraim and the son of Remaliah has devised evil against you, let us go up against Judah and terrify it, and let us conquer for ourselves. Thus says the Lord God, it shall not stand, and it shall not come to pass, for the head of Syria is Damascus, and the head of Damascus is Rezin, and the head of Ephraim is Samaria, and the head of Samaria is the son of Remaliah. If you will not believe, surely you will not be established. And then there's the little parenthesis on the terms of the number of years. The greatest, maybe it's almost, I guess, the thing that I think of in connection with Ahaz is one of FDR's most quoted lines, the worst thing you have to fear is fear itself. The anxiety, the precipitous anxiety of Ahaz is one of the things that is being addressed. Take heed, be quiet, do not fear, do not let your heart be faint. There's nothing that precipitates quick compromises. There's nothing that gets us to settle for a short-term solution rather than a long-term solution quicker than a kind of panic. The only thing we can do is this. There is nothing that, so that one of the salvageable themes that I hear here is that Yahweh is the advocate of the longer vision, and Isaiah is trying to calm and the leadership and get them to think long term, in terms not simply of their own day-to-day survival, but in terms of the long-term survival of the people. Okay, notice that Emmanuel is another kid name, stuck right in here, and I said at the beginning that as far as I can see, the virgin or the maiden conceiving and having Emmanuel is another prophet child sign from Isaiah to Ahaz, and probably another one of Isaiah's own children. And if you can find a way to read it messianically, I wish you would, because I'd rather read it that way, but I just don't find it in the text. And the Emmanuel sign is not so much a sign of caution, don't panic. The Emmanuel sign is sort of a double sign. The people you're afraid of now, Assyria and Damascus, are going to be overturned, but the king of Assyria will be coming also up to Judah. So that this is sort of the posing of the long-run problem. On the one hand, Isaiah is telling Ahaz, you're over-anxious about the short-run problem. And on the other hand, he's telling him, you're really not thinking hard enough about the long-run problem. You're panicking and getting the king of Assyria here to solve the problem of Syria and Samaria, but you're forgetting that the king of Assyria is going to come on up there. And then belonging to Maher Shal Ahashbaz, that's in 8.
Tell us where you're reading those songs?
Isaiah 8, 1 now. The third, this is Isaiah chapter 7 and 8. This other one is the spoil speeds, the prey hastes. So it's a kind of threatening child name. And the meaning of the name is in verse 4, for before the child knows how to cry, my father or my mother, the wealth of Damascus and the spoil of Samaria will be carried away before the king of Assyria. So that before the child can speak. Now notice the Emmanuel sign, it was by the time the child reaches the age of discretion, this will happen. With this one, it's before the child can speak, this one will happen. So that the child with the name is a portent. It's a sign, and the name gives the clue to what the child then will remind the people of, so that every time they see Isaiah's kid running around town with that name, the sermon, that's a pretty expensive way to make a sermon point, but every time they see that kid then, they'll remember the father's sermon. And every time the kid says, my name is Emmanuel, then it'll be, they'll remember the sermon about God coming in the Assyrian armies. And so that there's a real drama and intimacy and symbolism. I guess I'd rather have children called Faith, Hope, and Charity, and Christopher and things like that, but these probably were really important kinds of ways of doing it. Anyhow, the third one, this Maher Shal Ahashbaz, is a sign, the name is the sign of the the spoil of Samaria being carried away and the king of Assyria coming. And then again it's a statement of these kings and the king of Assyria and all his glory. Notice, it's interesting, notice how the king is called by the name of the Euphrates, the mighty river. You find that in verse 7, therefore behold the Lord is bringing up against them the waters of the river. And the countries are personified. The waters of the river, mighty and many, the king of Assyria and all his glory, and it will rise over all its channels and go over all its banks, and it will sweep on into Judah, and it will overflow and pass on, reaching even up to the neck, and its outspread wings will fill the breadth of your land, O Immanuel. Marvelous image of the flood, of an army being like the flood. How the flood comes and creeps up and covers the whole valley. Somebody was telling me that somebody had to go home today because parts of Fargo were flooded. And
the Red River.
Good old Red River. And here you have that image, which is very familiar both in Egypt and in Mesopotamia. You find that image then being used about the Assyrian army, which will come and overflow. And so Isaiah is really reasoning out the relationship of Yahweh to politics. He is reasoning out what on earth does it mean that Assyria is on the horizon. What sense, what meaning can we draw from these from foreign relations? Can we go on believing in Yahweh and his providence and his concern in the midst of all the chaos of the power struggles among the nations? And then there's a little bit more on this same sign in 8:11. For the Lord spoke thus to me with his strong hand upon me. Do not call conspiracy all that the people call conspiracy, and do not fear what they fear, nor be in dread. Don't panic. You'll lose your head. You'll not take account of the deeper forces of historical life in which the Lord is operating. But the Lord of hosts, him shall you regard as holy. Let him be your fear, and let him be your dread. If you are open to the integrity and the accountability of historical processes, then there is the possibility that you can live in a world where there is integrity and accountability and justice. If you are open to historical process as simply a power struggle, then it is inevitable that you will be a victim of the capriciousness of power. There, just in connection with this, there are some very interesting metaphors that are spun out of the army of Assyria coming, and I toss them in not because I think they're great metaphors. 7:18, in that day the Lord will whistle for the fly which is at the sources of the streams of Egypt, and for the bee which is in the land of Assyria. Notice the picture of God to Egypt, to the fly in Egypt, and the bee in Assyria to come and harass, bite and sting Samaria and Judah. What a earthy, ordinary. God calls the insects to sting his people, and to think about that when the flies and when you get stung the next time. And 20. In that day, the Lord will shave with a razor which is hired beyond the river. The king of Assyria's army is going to be like a razor, like the barber, which comes and shaves the hair off the head. The aristocrats are the head, the people in power are the head, and the poor people are the feet. He's going to shave the head and the hair of the feet, and it will take away the beard also. So it's going to be a pretty clean shave. It's going to be a pretty clean shave. Next time you go to the barber, remember. Remember that the Lord can use razors too. In that day, a man will keep alive a young cow and two sheep, and because of the abundance of milk, he will eat curds, for everyone that is left in the land will eat curds and honey. That's all there'll be to eat, is the simple foods from a young cow and a couple of sheep.
Vern, is there a second reference on that razor image? Didn't the Assyrians mount swords on the axles of their chariots and cut the feet of foot soldiers fighting against them?
Could be, could be.
They would cut a swath right through the enemy troops that you'd see.
Could be.
The razor image operating.
Could very well be. There was a, I haven't read it myself, but it makes sense. There is a lot of, one of the major things, you know, in the whole series of oracles in the first part of Amos, is that one of the major crimes that the Lord holds against the different countries is that they start using more vicious weapons. So that if you start using more vicious weapons, you can expect that when the other person has more vicious weapons, they will use them on you. If you drop atomic bombs on other people, you can't expect that when somebody else has atomic bombs, they aren't going to drop them on us. And so that these prophets are, the important thing is that they don't perceive the just judgment of God as at all a capricious thing. This isn't just God having a fit of temper. You know, like I have sometimes, you know, I get frustrated and, you know, that's not the way, they don't see God as a hot-headed Frenchman at all. They see God as being very, very responsible, very retributive, so that in measure, as Israel and Samaria does, that's the measure they get in return. If they invent. So, okay, and then there's the other one, 23, in that day, every place where there used to be 1,000 vines worth 1,000 shekels of silver will become briars and thorns. Won't be any water anymore. Marvelous scarcity image, these places where they know desert and they know river valley where they can keep the, and they know the vines growing along the river valley and they know the rains, and they were very much aware that if the weather changed, the rains didn't come, if they ran out of, if the floods were different, then all of these beautiful, supportive resources would go away. They were aware of the precariousness of their whole agricultural life. So one of the very simple things that is a kind of a reminder of their dependence is the drought. And when the Lord, all the Lord has to do is withdraw the, not send the rains, not protect them from the larger forces on the right and left, and they wither up. Their valleys go back to deserts. Notice, the real issue is that Judah and Israel, I think Isaiah puts his finger on it when he talks about pride. The real issue is that they forgot they were dependent. They forgot that they lived in, that the human life and community life was in a narrow zone, a dependency zone, not a secure, solid, impregnable, divine thing. It was a dependency zone in which and where they were prospered because there was integrity and following of Torah and covenant, and where they prospered because of the protection and the meaning that Yahweh gave to them and the way in which he cared for them. So that when they forget that they're in a dependency zone, the only way for Yahweh to bring them to their self again, the only way for Yahweh to create a human consciousness, in other words, to try to get them to have a human consciousness rather than a God consciousness, they were acting as though they were their contribution to life, and bearing fruit was a way of demonstrating maturity and productivity and this sort of thing, and comes pretty naturally, and it's hard to be in a society where the frontier has changed a little bit, and we have to have different ways of find new ways of showing our fruitfulness and productivity. But anyhow, there's a special intimacy between the vineyard and the vine. First, the friend of the vine dresser. Let me sing for my beloved a love song concerning his vineyard. My beloved had a vineyard on a very fertile hill. He digged it, and he cleared it of the stones, and he planted it with choice vine. He built a watchtower in the middle of it. He hewed a wine vat in it, the watchtower, to protect the vines from the fields and from the animals. He hewed a wine vat in it to be ready for the grapes, so when they're just at the right point, they can go right into the wine. No overripe, no underripe. The wine vat's right there at the edge of the vineyard. And he looked for it to yield grapes. He did everything, you know, he did everything that he knew how to do. A good soil, cleared away the rocks, the very best vines, the very best stock, watchtower so that somebody could be around to take care of it, wine vat. Let me sing for my beloved a love song concerning his vineyard. My beloved had a vineyard on a very fertile hill. He digged it and cleared it of stones and planted it with choice vines. He built a watchtower in the middle of it and hewed out a wine vat in it. And he looked for it to yield grapes, but it yielded wild grapes.